I think a materialist approach to things is very, very consistent with my experience in Christian social justice.
I feel like the deeper I get into anarchist practice, the deeper my faith is getting at the same time.
I would hope that, you know, securing means of life for all would be something all people of faith would say, oh yes, that's at the basis of what we believe.
And those who are most marginalized know the most about the truth, good, and the beautiful.
To me, it's less that I think building class solidarity is a bad thing, as much as it seems like if you don't attend to things like anti-Black racism, that's always going to get in the way of building class solidarity, actually.
And when you go back, you find that a lot of revolutionary grassroots participatory movements, the precursors to what you could call the barrio assemblies and these, like, you know, grassroots neighborhood organizations, a lot of these were sponsored by the church.
What does it mean to say that the Christian tradition is internally contradictory and there are antagonisms there? You're always being faithful to some aspects and betraying other aspects.
Welcome to the Magnificast, a podcast about Christianity and leftist politics. I'm your singular only host this week. Dean is here. Don't let me steer you wrong, but he's not the co-host. He's the interviewee this week. He's the interviewed man. Couldn't tell you. He's here.
The interviewee. I'm on the other side of the curtain, and I gotta tell you, I'm on both sides. It looks great over here. I'm living a real amphibious kind of life, a real cyborg kind of situation, a centaur experience. I can't think of any other hybrids, but it's kind of all those things at once.
Yeah, Donna Haraway was right. We're all cyborgs now. We're all centaurs now. mostly just you. I'm regular this week, folks. It's been 2 weeks since we've had a new episode, and that's maybe it's been 3 weeks even. Who's counting? That's real tragedy. But we're back this week. Dean, he took not a vacation at all. He took a trip. He went to Nepal to the World Social Forum and the World Forum on Theology and Liberation to do the work of theology and social movements. And that is rad as hell. So we thought we would just kind of spend this week having Dean talk about his experience in Nepal. And I don't know. Is that okay, Dean? Can I do that to you? Can I ask you those questions?
I don't think you can do it to me, but you can definitely do it with me.
Okay. Yeah, good point. That's keeping that good cyborg energy going, co-conspirators in this podcast.
Yeah, it's true. I went to Nepal, an incredibly wild country, on it felt like the exact opposite side of the world, and still my body feels like it's on the opposite side of the world. I've been here for a week back in Toronto, and today is the first day I woke up at a normal time, a normal human time, at 8:30 a.m. That felt great, and slowly integrating back into Canadian society. It was a wild trip, but you know what I loved about it, Matt? I thought about our podcast a lot while I was away, because we spend so much time reading old books about liberation theology, books that are out of print, or we found somewhere on the internet, or someone sent it to us in the mail, or whatever. It feels like we do a lot of archival work around liberation theology, but this time I was able to see it up live close, what's going on in liberation theology, and that was really cool. It was really exciting to be like, wow, this is a thing that still exists, and people in the Global South are still talking about it, and the rest of us in the North need to catch up, I think, to what's going on. So it was great to see what's actually happening.
As a reader of old out-of-print books, that's really good news to me that in 20 more years, I can go back and read whatever's coming out right now. Exciting.
That's right. Yeah, Whip and Stock will be reprinting them all, I'm sure.
Yeah, I can't wait. I can't wait till 2050 so I can be warned upon about all the things that are happening. Man, what? Dean, can you believe it? We were just two Midwestern boys, and now we're globe-trotting international people living around the world, going places. Isn't that wild?
It is wild.
It's hard to believe, honestly. Anyways, we've talked about Nepal like before, just shooting the shit between us. But I'm going to ask you now in a programmatic podcasty kind of way questions about Nepal that I think everyone will really enjoy, or at least be interested in a non-enjoyable way. You went to Nepal Dean, when you first told me you were going there, I did have to look it up on a map. I didn't know where it was exactly. I knew it was like, you know, maybe by India somewhere, but I couldn't tell you exactly where. So why did you go to Nepal? What was it like? What were the top three foods that you ate when you were there?
A lot of great questions all at once. Man, being under Matt's hot microscope over here is, yeah. I'm sweating as a guest. This must be how everybody feels. Where is it is a great question. I also had to look it up on a map when I discovered I was going to go there. It's pretty fascinating. It's squished between China and India. And it is one of the only countries in the world that was never colonized directly by a Christian power, which is pretty fascinating, or by a Muslim power. And that definitely shapes the consciousness of the country in a pretty big way. And it is kind of, I don't know, always trying to figure out how to do its own thing in between these two big powers and also other global powers in the last century, the US and the Soviet Union, for example. Just an interesting little tiny country trying to figure it out. And I went there because in that tiny country, they held the World Social Forum for the second time in Asia. The World Social Forum is a big group of social movements that meets every 2 years in different parts of the world. And usually it meets in Latin America and Africa. They met in Montreal once. I think that's the only time it's ever been in the north. But it met in India one time, and apart from that, has never been in Asia. So it was a big kind of Asian focus at the forum. And Nepal, I was told by a few Nepali folks that I met, is kind of like the Switzerland of Asia, that it's sort of a neutral ground in which many different people can sort of meet and talk. And it seemed like a good place for a social forum. So that's why I went. And top three foods that I ate are all varying kinds of momos. Momos are the big food in Nepal. They're basically dumplings. They're kind of like Nepali pierogies, I guess, is more similar to where I'm from in the Midwest. But man, they're great. And they do them in so many different ways. They boil them. They fry them. They put them on a weird sort of Applebee's style skillet and bring them out to you sizzling. However you want them, they'll give you these momos. And boy, did I eat a lot of them.
That is very cool. Man, I love momo. I looked them up. I've never had one, but I want one really bad. It seems great. That's like one of the top foods you ate. There, you need two more, though, to complete the question. You are in the hot seat. You're under the hot lamp, heating up. You're sweating, but you do have to answer the question.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. I was trying to avoid it by saying there are so many kinds of momos.
That's just one type of food.
But, okay, fair enough. all right, well, so when I stayed there, I, for the first part, was staying at a residence of the Jesuits in Nepal, which was very interesting in itself. And we had a lot of vaguely defined curries and lentils that I still don't exactly know what they were, but was assured they were vegetarian. That was great. So whatever curry this one particular guy was making for us every day, at first it was one of the top foods that I ate. But after eating it literally every single day for sometimes twice a day, it did slowly get to the bottom of that ladder. But I'll say at the beginning, it was close to the top. Also, I did have so I had my birthday in Nepal, which is great. And I went to a restaurant where I had curry paneer tacos, which was a great birthday meal.
That sounds really good. Were they just like soft shell tacos?
Yeah, exactly. With this paneer and like curry and chutney. Man, it was great. What a great fusion idea. Dang,
that sounds like a great taco. Feeling pretty hungry for... I had Taco Bell today, and that probably wasn't even anywhere near as close as good. So anyways, I'm thinking about this. That sounds great. Okay.
When we do the episode where I interview you about living in Scotland, I do want to hear about the weird Scottish Taco Bell, but we can save that for next time.
Yeah, it's painfully normal, unfortunately.
That's too bad.
It's too bad. I can tell you about haggis tacos someday, though. Okay. So that's great. You went to Nepal for all these great reasons. You ate the momos, and we're all very jealous of your momo eating. But where is Nepal on the map? Like, if you had to tell somebody where it was on the globe... on this great round earth we do live on, how would you tell them?
Yeah, all right. Well, like I said, it's squished between China and India, and it's geographically in a pretty interesting spot also because the part of China that it is squished against, China, I'm starting to sound like Donald Trump already, watch him too much on the internet. The part of China that it is up against is near Tibet. And so there are a lot of Tibetans in Nepal and a lot of Tibetans who fled all the wild situation happening there in China and Tibet. They fled into Nepal. And so there's a huge influence of Tibetan culture and Buddhism and so on there. And also Nepali culture is really fascinating because it is kind of a mashup of India and sort of Tibet and China all at once. So that's pretty intriguing. And that geopolitical situation also creates a lot of opportunity and tension for Nepal. Like, they're always pressed against both of these countries in ways that I think are increasingly more challenging because China and India are, you know, not only getting more powerful on the global stage, but also, like, politically have their own kind of agendas, and Nepal has to maybe, like, waver between both of them or figure out what to do. It's also an interesting place because culturally they're quite similar to India. It's a very Hindu majority country in Nepal, for example. But politically, they had a Maoist revolution in the 90s that had that succeeded in the early 2000s in overthrowing the monarchy. And they're governed by a coalition of communist governments or communist parties. And Maoism has a big influence there. So they have this, like, cultural similarity to India, but this, like, political tradition from China. And they're all just sort of figuring it out there in Nepal. So geopolitically, a really wild kind of country.
That is really fascinating, actually. A big a gumbo, if you will, of things going on there. You said that there's a coalition of communist governments, which I think is probably a pretty unique feature of the communism they've built in Nepal. Do you want to say something about that?
Yeah. So there's a lot of great books on it that you can read. One thing I thought was pretty fascinating being there is you don't really hear a lot about Nepal in conversations about socialism or communism, which I think is too bad because it is a relatively recent experiment in socialism. So the Maoist insurrection, they succeeded in basically, well, they overthrew the monarchy in 2006, and then they had a new constitution in 2008, and it declared Nepal as a secular state, for example, and you know, lots of other things too around education and land reform and all the stuff you expect from communists. And it's interesting because the Maoists had done this insurrection, but there were already several other communist parties doing stuff in Nepal and also participating electorally in the constitutional monarchy system. So when the new constitution was finished, the communist parties sort of competed with one another for votes, and then they've had kind of a series of unifications and splits. It's all very interesting. It's like a multi-party communist democracy. There are other parties also, so there's like a kind of, even right now, actually when I was there, where I was staying, there was like a huge, like, Hindu nationalist rally, which was kind of disconcerting to me specifically, but so that is still there, but it's interesting because it is an experiment in multi-party communist democracy. And I spoke with a communist organizer in Kathmandu, and he was saying that in the communist movement there, there's a lot of talk about how they're really accomplishing a kind of innovation in communism in the 21st century, which is to say, could there be a variety of communist visions, each with their own parties, who sort of work together to figure out what is the best future for Nepal? Rather than, like, folding everybody into one party or establishing a one-party state and kind of, like, making that the terms in which all public discourse happens, could there be this room for, like, a socialist plurality? And I don't know. It's, I think, very complicated. It doesn't seem like It's a incredibly smooth political process, to say the least, but nevertheless a really fascinating kind of experiment that people don't seem to talk about very much.
That's fair. I can't imagine a lot of different communists being a smooth sort of political situation, but I think it's cool that they're trying. I don't know. It's such a fascinating thing to hear about, though, because, you know, you got places like Cuba that are kind of more, I don't want to say like the Soviet Union, because they're quite different than the Soviet Union, but similar in the sense that there's a one party state and that there's sort of like competing pushes and pulls within the party. And then you have like, mm-hmm. I don't know, all kinds of other leftist experiments where there's no party and there's, you know, autonomous kind of organizations and whatever, the Occupy Wall Streets of the world and whatnot. But then you have many communist parties unifying and sometimes against one another. I don't know. That is really fascinating. And it's surprising that people don't talk about it. We should maybe have an episode later where we talk about that in particular. That would be a fun thing to learn about. A great segue of socialism in the 21st century. Communism is happening in different ways and all kinds of different places. Pretty cool.
Yeah, it's super interesting too, because like I was asking people when I was there, what do you think about the government? What do you think about the revolution and so on? And because it was the World Social Forum, I had the opportunity, I guess, to talk to lots of different people from very different parts of Nepal. And the general sentiment that I got, which I thought was pretty fascinating, is a lot of people felt like the revolution was necessary, not always justifiably violent, but sometimes, yes, you know, kind of like every kind of thing you'd expect, I guess, talking to people about violent communist revolution, you kind of get a pretty reasonable range of opinion. But when it came to the current state of things and the governing parties, people were not super psyched about it. Like, it didn't feel like a very participatory system. And I asked this communist organizer I was talking with what he thought, because all these people I was asking were progressives, you know, for lack of a better term, socialists, communists, maybe. But in any case, not conservative people. And this organizer I was talking with was also saying, yeah, like the liability of the multi-party system is that you do kind of get like stuck sometimes in party infighting. And the challenge is always to create some unified front to build socialism in Nepal. And that is like a real issue. And he was saying it can create alienation between the party and the people. But nevertheless, it's also, it seems like a struggle worth having, because it's like, I don't know, how do you build that future with, you know, not forcing everybody to be the exact same kind of communist, but nevertheless, like trying to build socialism anyway. Anyway, all very interesting. And I also would like to learn a lot more about it for sure.
Cool. Well, sounds like a future plan. The other part of the equation, though, that is interesting about Nepal is that it is a communist country, but also a like profoundly religious one, though not a profoundly Christian country, which is a cool dynamic, actually. So what's the religious situation like in Nepal?
Yeah, it is definitely majority Hindu country, demographically and infrastructurally. I mean, it's there is a shrine to some deity around literally every corner. The country is wild, because it's like there's a shop to buy cell phones, a shop to buy TVs, a weird place where people are just like living or something, you're not quite sure, a place where you can get a chai tea, and then also like a shrine where people are doing like lighting candles and so on. And like sometimes it seems very clear what's going on, and then other times not, even to Nepalis. Like if you ask a Nepali person what's the shrine to or whatever, sometimes they know and sometimes they don't. So it's really like a very devotional kind of place, at least Kathmandu. I should say, like, pretty much I was only in Kathmandu. There's lots of other parts of Nepal that I didn't get to see. But in the city, that's the case. The other big influence there is Buddhism. And Buddhism and Hinduism are kind of like stacked on top of each other throughout the country in interesting ways. So you go to a big temple and the Buddhists go there for their reasons. The Hindus go there for their reasons. And they're all just kind of like in the mix, and the religions sort of blend together in these interesting ways. And then there's an incredibly small minority of Muslims, Christians, and other kinds of people hanging around. And the religious situation is pretty fascinating. It's illegal to proselytize in Nepal, but it's not illegal to convert. So that is pretty fascinating. I was talking to a Catholic priest there about it, and he was like, yeah, we don't proselytize and don't really feel the need to do that. We're just like teaching. They have like some schools and stuff, and they do mass, of course, and things like that. And he was like, we basically just assume that if we are good Christian people, eventually people will be interested, and they are. And there's like a very small but pretty thriving Catholic church in Nepal. There's also, though, that being said, a growing number of evangelical Protestant churches, which is like, I don't know, becoming kind of a problem, I think, which is pretty wild and interesting. But still, Christianity is like an extreme minority across the country. And politically, it's interesting because the secular state is an important designation that it kind of creates a space for different faiths to thrive in Nepal. But that designation is also being challenged because of the rise of Hindu nationalism in India. So there's like a major pressure on Nepal right now to backtrack on that secularity, which is pretty recent. Like, they've only been a secular state since 2008. So religiously very interesting place. But I'll say, even with that said, like, it's a pretty hospitable sort of situation. Like, I never got the sense that there was really religious tension or kind of like, you know, there's a Hindu nationalist sentiment in Nepal, but you don't really feel it on the streets or anything like that. Like, I don't know, people weren't being too fashy about it, at least that I could tell. And Nepalis have a very like proud history of being hospitable to others and outsiders. I think in part also because they don't have that direct experience of colonization. The British did try, and they beat them, which they say very proudly. You know, they have maybe a more kind of interesting, open religious situation.
We love to hear people beating the British. That's great. as a person in Scotland, I think that's a great message, a great thing to strive for. just kidding, Home Office, if you're listening. What is the dynamic between the various communist parties and the religious makeup of the country? Is there like a tension like you might expect, or I don't know, have they figured out that dynamic in a different way?
Yeah, I asked this communist organizer about that, and he said pretty proudly that people have a freedom of religion in Nepal, and that is fine with the communist parties. He also was like, there's basically just no way to not have religion in Nepal. It is so like thickly Hindu. The analogy that kept coming to mind for me was thinking about the Sandinista revolution in Nicaragua. It's not exactly the same, because the communist movement in Nepal, it does sometimes kind of use Hindu language, but more because that's like the culture and mythology that they have available, rather than like the Sandinistas were seeking kind of a fusion, I guess, in some cases between Christianity and Marxism. But the analogy is just that there's this assumption that, you know, you're not going to like secularize an entire populace overnight, especially in a country with such deep roots in a particular tradition. And it seems like that's the style of communist politics there, that there's just a recognition that people are religious and that is fine. You know, there are some like, I guess, points of tension you could guess. Like, the caste system still exists in parts of Nepal in ways that are complicated, and the Communist Party is very like intentionally opposed to the caste system. And so there can be some tensions there. There's also some political tensions with Hindu loyalists who are like, you know, they still see the restoration of the monarchy as the way to, I don't know, build a good society in Nepal, and that is at odds with the communist vision. So those are some points of tension, I suppose, but the communist party as a secular party, or parties as secular parties, are not anti-religious per se.
Huh, that's so neat. So neat to hear. Man, well, I feel like there's a bunch of more questions I could ask about Nepal, mostly about tacos, because that's all I'm thinking about right now. But let's talk about the World Social Forum and the World Forum on Theology and Liberation a little bit, because that's why you were there. I mean, you were in Nepal, and that's all very cool. And keep the Nepal facts coming, I guess, if they apply. But let's talk about the other two events really quickly. So what's the World Social Forum? Why? What is it, and why is it, I guess, is my question.
Good question. The World Social Forum has been around since the early 2000s. It kind of grew out of Latin American left spaces for exchanging information and dialogue between activists. It was kind of like there was already a culture of doing that in Latin America, but they built it out in these more institutional ways in the early 2000s. And it's basically like a global forum for people to, to share strategy, analysis, and so on. At least that's the idea of it. It is also like, it's called the World Social Forum in contradistinction to the World Economic Forum explicitly. So the kind of undertone is that all the capitalists get together and they compare notes and share all their big strategies. So maybe we should do that on the other side as well. It cycles around to different places every couple of years. There's definitely like some growing criticism about it, that it's kind of like NGOified, or it's too establishment, or the kind of like radical roots that maybe were present there have been uprooted in the institutionalization of the forum. And like, I don't know, I've only been to one of them, so I really couldn't say. But I guess I'm just flagging that because people on the left have criticisms of it. But I found it really interesting, a pretty generative kind of space. Also, there's a liberation theology component kind of built into it. The first social forum happened in Brazil, and the liberation theologians jumped onto that pretty quickly. And they have also had a hand in kind of organizing the social forum. In fact, there's a priest who's passed away now, Francois Guittard in Belgium. He was one of the founders of the World Social Forum. And that, I think, has some interesting wrinkles to it. So all that to say, the forum itself is that kind of space. So it's like you've got landless workers movements there. You have labor unions that go. There are all kinds of like NGOs, development organizations, things like that. There are different socialist parties who are present, and it's kind of like a very anarchic situation. Like anybody who is a participant there can just like propose a workshop or like a panel or whatever. And I don't know what the vetting process is, but as far as I can tell, there's not really one. There were some really wild sessions going on. I was telling you, Matt, before I went, so I was like, you know, trying to build a bit of a schedule to be like, oh, these are the events I want to go, the stuff I want to learn about. And there was this like particular group of people that were really lobbying hard that the World Social Forum should be like the provisional world government replacing the United Nations. And like, it was like a proposal made in all sincerity. And they held events at the social forum and they were passing out pamphlets for people to go. They were serious. So there's like everything from that kind of thing to like, I don't know, some like NGO talking about like women's education in whatever, like rural, I don't know, wherever, that kind of thing, you know, typical development work. So it's a pretty big hodgepodge of stuff, but that's the social forum itself. I'll stop. I'm talking a lot, but I'll stop there before I talk about liberation theology.
No, that sounds great. I think that the World Social Forum should be the provisional government of Earth. That sounds cool. Why not? I mean, it couldn't be any worse than the United Nations, I think.
It's true.
So anyways, sounds cool. Can you give an example of some of like the panels that you went to?
You know, the crazy thing is like, so you build a schedule, you're like, here's where I'm going to go. I mean, I've been to dozens of conferences in the past, so, you know, I know the drill. You look it up online, you find the papers you want to hear, and then you go to them. And so before I went, I made this big table, a big spreadsheet of all the things I wanted to go to. And I was showing it to somebody the first day that I got there, somebody that I was staying with. And this person said to me, that is great that you prepared that way. You should also be prepared to basically not see any of those things that you want to see. I was like, okay. And they said, tomorrow when you go to the forum, you'll just kind of see what the vibe is. And like, maybe you'll end up where you want to go. And maybe you'll end up in some completely unexpected place. And that person was completely right. I had a huge list of places and people I wanted to hear. But at the end of the day, I did not hear most of them. But I did end up hearing all kinds of weird stuff. For example, by accident, I thought I was going to one talk, but it had moved, like it changed locations. And there's no like there's really no way of knowing what's going on. Like, the whole thing's kind of a mess. And so the place where I ended up was actually a really interesting talk from a group of religious sisters in India, coincidentally, who were working against human trafficking. But they were also like pretty hardcore women. Like, they were super anti-capitalist. They were really into liberation theology. And they were also like in the thick of like preventing and taking people out of the exploitation system and a lot of like labor trafficking and basically slave labor that's going on. So super fascinating to listen to all these like Indian religious women kind of talk about like capitalism and how it works and why people are sucked into it. So that is like probably a quintessential example of how the World Social Forum works. You go there with a plan to like hear some academic that you want to hear talk about global debt or something, and instead of doing that, you end up hearing a bunch of like religious sisters talk to you about human trafficking instead.
Seems like a pretty good trade-off, honestly. That sounds cool. Just sort of like a big activist-y psychogeography. You're drifting around. Something's taking you in.
That's right.
All right. That's neat. Yeah. And then you also went to the World Forum on Theology and Liberation, which is like an attached sort of situation. What was that like?
Yeah, so it's a parallel kind of forum. So it travels around with the World Social Forum, at least it has till now. And the idea is that it's a space for liberation theologians to gather and not only share papers and research, although there is that, like people presented papers, I presented a paper, there's that kind of like typical boring academic stuff. Less boring at a liberation theology thing, but boring elsewhere. That part's there, but there's also, it's kind of a way for theologians to hear from social movements themselves and encounter them and kind of take that as data or like a laboratory even to test some of the theological stuff they're working on. And it's also a way for theologians to get to know the context of wherever the social forum is. So, for example, because we were in Nepal, we spent a lot of time in the Liberation Theology Forum learning about what is it like for Christians in Nepal, how are they dialoguing with the political situation there. And since the social forum was happening in Asia, there was a huge focus on Asian theologies of liberation in particular. So there was kind of a concerted effort among the forum to bring people from Asia to that space and just kind of give it over to them to talk to each other, which was really fascinating. There was also a huge focus on Palestine this year. Mitri Raheb, who's a pretty amazing Lutheran theologian. If you haven't read any of his books, you should go read them. Extremely impressive guy. He was there, and also another Palestinian person, Varsen Agabekian, who teaches at the same institution as Mitri Raheb. So they were both there, and they kind of took center stage for the theology forum in an intentional way. Like, they set aside time to kind of talk through the crisis there, and it was pretty powerful. I mean, they came from the West Bank to be with us in Nepal, which is pretty nuts. And they spent a lot of time not only sharing about the current situation and kind of contextualizing it and so on, but really thinking through like what are the theological consequences of what's happening in Gaza, especially. Something that Mitri Raheb had said a lot is that the big theological question of the 20th century seemed to be, you know, how do you do theology after the Holocaust or after Auschwitz, and kind of taking that critical theory question on as well. But he said in the 21st century, the big question is going to be, how do you do theology after Gaza? Like, it's a kind of pivotal genocidal moment, and Christianity is complicit in it, and theologians don't know what to do with it. And he spent a lot of time also talking about how a lot of otherwise progressive theologians have had a lot of Zionist things to say or Zionist parts of their theologies. He was talking about people like Walter Brueggemann and Jürgen Moltmann and kind of the, you know, the big progressive people that people like to talk about. And he was sort of pointing out that they have these Zionist pieces baked into their work. So a big part of the forum on theology and liberation this year was just being able to kind of hear from the two of them about what their situation is like and really think through together as theologians, what does that mean for doing theology in a global way?
That's really interesting to hear that's what you're doing theology in light of in the 21st century. I guess it's a really terrifying prospect, honestly, given the way that I think people have like really fumbled the previous theological question about theology after the Holocaust. Yikes. Well, I don't know. Was there, I guess what else is on like the cutting edge of liberation theology that you were there to witness?
Yeah. It was interesting to get a sense of it. I mean, there were some pretty wild characters there. For example, there was a guy named Jose Maria Vigil, who is a Sandinista priest historically, and it was wild to meet him, a person whose books that I have read in person, and to be like, wow, this is like a living person of history for me, who is not just a historical like author of an out-of-print Orbis book, but an actual living human being. So it was interesting to kind of have that continuity with liberation struggles around the world and kind of hear how they're thinking about liberation theology. But there were also a number of younger people there thinking from their own contexts. And like I said, to a lot of people from Asia. And the big kind of theme, apart from Palestine, that was coming out was a lot of attention on indigenous theologies and kind of how do indigenous people do theology on their own terms? How do we decolonize theology? That was a big conversation. And it was pretty fascinating to be there. There were a lot of different indigenous folks, indigenous people from Nepal, indigenous people from parts of Asia, including India, for example, and of course, Mitri and Varsin from Palestine, and kind of having these conversations, you know, in Indonesia and Korea, like being able to sort of see all these folks sort of draw parallels between colonial experiences and how they're indigenizing theology in their own contexts was really quite fascinating and interesting. One of the most interesting things to me was especially talking with younger indigenous Catholics, especially from Indonesia and Nepal. They were pointing out that to them, Catholicism, like, it has its colonial problems. It has a lot of colonial kind of trappings and stuff that are hard to navigate. But they saw it as a way of practicing Christianity that also allows them to hold on to their indigenous practice and spirituality as something that's not competitive, but sort of, you know, in partnership alongside their Christian tradition. And they were saying, like, younger Protestant friends that they have seem to struggle a lot more with that they're like caught, I guess, between the tension of being like, is my, you know, family's ancestral practice biblical? And if not, then I guess I have to jettison it or get rid of it. And so they were sort of seeing Catholicism as, you know, not without its complications or contradictions, which they're very quick to point out, but nevertheless, a kind of like space to also have an indigenous expression of Christianity. So I got the impression that was also kind of on the cutting edge of liberation theology today. People really thinking through both the coloniality of Christianity and then also like what kinds of alternative Christianities are maybe, you know, bubbling up in other parts of the world.
That's such a rad thing to hear about, honestly. I love that. What do you think it is about Catholicism that kind of lends itself to that particular type of expression or like formation, I guess, of like an indigenous Catholicism that Protestantism can't really get behind?
Yeah, it's a good question. I was trying to think of that as well. And I guess there's two things that come to mind for me. The first is that there is a sort of emphasis on enculturation in Catholicism, a kind of openness to cultural difference, whereas, you know, it's not that Protestants don't have that or can't have that and haven't had that in many good examples, but especially the kind of evangelical forms of Protestantism, you know, they tend to identify what it means to be biblical with Western culture, right? And that was evident, I think. I met a couple of evangelicals in Nepal, and that seemed to me to be the case. Like, they were talking to me about all kinds of Western evangelical authors who I think are otherwise extremely boring. And, you know, to them, that was like the pinnacle of theology and like how to be a good Christian and so on. And I thought that was very bizarre. And by contrast, the Catholic Nepali people that I was talking with were like talking to me with a lot of excitement about like different Hindu stories, Buddhist stories and so on that mean a lot to them and kind of help them figure out their own faith. So I think there's like, I guess just maybe less competition, at least in these experiences between, you know, that indigenous way of being and thinking and imagining and Catholic identity. And of course, like, this is all with like a gigantic asterisk because it's not, I don't think that's like, that's historically obviously not endemic to Catholicism.
Right.
Like, yeah. You know, in lots of situations, Catholics have done exactly the opposite. But in this particular case, that's how these people are navigating it. And the other piece that I thought was interesting is that even with that space being made, a lot of the younger Catholics were saying, too, that they still struggle with all the same stuff everybody else struggles with in the church. Like, oh, my priest is extremely conservative and I don't like him. And he keeps telling me that I shouldn't do this or that indigenous practice. And they're like, but, you know, whatever. That's just my priest. Like, I don't really care. Like, also a pretty standard kind of Catholic attitude, I guess.
Sure.
So I don't know what it is in Catholicism that kind of lends that. But that also seems to be a universal kind of experience to just be like, your priest says one thing, but like, I don't know. If you don't really like it, you just kind of forget about it. As opposed to with Protestantism, I feel like the sort of drive to be biblical is sometimes maybe a harder cross pressure because it like, kind of, you know, you become the cop yourself in your brain, as opposed to in Catholicism, you can like point out the cop that you don't like. That's the priest in this circumstance.
Yeah, no, that's a great analogy. Protestantism is especially bad because it does make you into your own brain cop. That's not great. We don't like that.
Yeah.
You gotta be on the lookout for that cop. Kick him out of your head. Don't let him live there. I was thinking about this too. You know, you went to this like other country all the way around the world. You went and talked to people who are from, you know, all over the place doing theology. What does that mean for you as a person who's like doing the work of the Catholic social movement in North America and as a person making a podcast or whatever, you know, doing Christian solidarity stuff? Like, I guess, how does that shape the way that you're thinking about theology and liberation in 2024 in this big global context?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, you know, I read a lot of books and I experience the world through reading those books for better and for worse. And I've read a lot of books about Asia and about Asian theology, but I have never been to Asia ever in my life. This is my first time going to Asia and going to an extremely particular part of it as well, in Nepal. And something that a Korean theologian that I was talking with had said that I thought was really funny, had said to me, he was like, welcome to Asia. It's the place where the majority of people live. And I thought that was a really funny kind of insight that the majority of the global population, they do live in Asian countries. And nevertheless, Christianity is a huge minority. I mean, that's a weird way to put it. It's not a huge minority. It's wild that it is a minority in such a big collection of people. And I think that has really stuck with me that, you know, I think as a person interested in liberation theology, my brain often goes to Latin America in particular because it's so thickly Christian, and then maybe to Africa because it's like maybe has a different kind of history with Christianity. And I've read some Asian theologians, but my mind doesn't really go to Asia very much, even thinking about kind of resources for theologizing and so on. And I think this kind of experience has really changed that for me. I'm like way more interested in what's happening in Asian theology now than I was before, and feel like I have a lot more homework to do and a lot of exciting reading to explore and so on. And I think even talking about liberation theology in that context was interesting because there is dialogue with liberation theology in Asia, but Asian theologies have their own kind of sources of, I don't know, language and inspiration and ways of talking about social justice and so on, and their own experiences of revolution and theologizing alongside those revolutions. So excited to learn a lot more about all that.
Yeah. Do you feel like between the Asian liberation theologians that you were, you know, with and among, like, what's that cross? Like, what's the cross? I want to say cross-contamination, but that's like probably not, that's a negative word for some reason. But I guess are they importing some of those ideas from Latin American liberation theology, or is it more based on their own context with just like, you know, some of the basic ideas of liberation theology built in? Or I don't know. How does that dynamic work out? Are they importing a lot of that, or is it more specific to their context?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of dialogue between them for sure. And Asian theologians have gone to not only the World Forum on Theology and Liberation for many years, but also the other kinds of things that happen, like EATWAT, the Ecumenical Association of Third World Theologians. So there have been lots of spaces for exchange, but I think it's kind of like, you know, when people talk about progressive theology in general, sometimes people just default to using the term liberation theology as though it's like a catch-all. Like, if someone is vaguely progressive, they must be doing liberation theology. And I think that is not quite right, both because liberation theologies have their own history. I mean, Latin American theology is one of them, but also, like, there's Black liberation theology. You know, there are other forms of liberation theologies out there that have their own distinct histories and source material. And when it comes to Asian theologies, I think it's interesting because they are in dialogue with what's happening abroad, but they're reaching into their own kind of situation. So, I mean, we've talked about some of them on this podcast in the past. Like a while ago, we were talking about Sebastian Kappan, this Indian theologian who was reading a ton of Latin American stuff and influenced his writing in Kerala, India, that sort of thing. But you also get these kinds of really creative engagements with their own traditions, like in Korea, Minjung theology, the kind of anti-dictatorial theology that was happening in Korea, really made up of thinking about the lowest class and kind of theologizing from that position. That is like a kind of theology that's, you know, endogenous to Korea, didn't sprout up with Latin American influence, sprouted up out of its own kind of context and situation. You get the same thing in the Philippines, right, with the theology of struggle, which we've talked about on the show, which is not liberation theology, but has its own kind of history and its own social movements that it's responding to. So all these kind of Asian theologies, it's like they're interested in what people are saying elsewhere, but they have their own kind of robust traditions of thinkers and theorists and even language and kind of spiritual traditions that they're pulling from, different engagements also with Buddhism and Hinduism and those kinds of things. So that I thought was really fascinating and something to learn a lot more about for sure.
That seems like a pretty striking difference. I mean, I think of it, for me, it's hard to imagine like Protestant Christianity in North America without its like counter position to like Islam or something. But I guess an interesting difference in the context that, you know, Christianity is alongside Buddhism or alongside Hinduism or something, a pretty different context. I don't know. Did you see that kind of come into liberation theology? Like not like a, I don't know, universalism necessarily, but like, I guess, how does that tension work with Christianity in Asia?
Yeah, you know, there was a really interesting paper by a guy named Paul Hwang, who is from Korea. He gave a great paper about kind of the way that Catholicism developed in Korea in a colonial way. And I won't do justice to his presentation, which is great. And I think that he's also going to publish the paper at some point. So I don't know. We'll just wait till it comes out. But one thing that he talked about is that in the history of Catholicism's reception in Korea, at a certain point, the Vatican banned ancestral worship. It issued a papal bull banning ancestral worship. And it was all very funny the way that he had presented this history, because the Jesuits, they end up in Korea. They have this approach of enculturation. The Franciscans and Dominicans, they get there and they're very conservative and also jealous of the Jesuits. So they basically tattle on them in the Vatican and they're like, did you know that the Jesuits are letting this happen? And the Vatican says, okay, that's not good. So they issue this bull. And when they do it, a lot of Catholics in Korea basically drop Catholicism because they're like, wait a second, like this was a bait and switch. Like I thought that we could still, you know, revere our ancestors and so on, and be Catholic at the same time. And if we can't do that, then like that is bad. Like, we don't want that. And it's not like there weren't any Catholics in Korea after that papal bull, but it like really damaged the church's reputation there. And he was trying to make this point that it was a colonial imposition of a certain kind of understanding of what ancestral worship is, what reverence for ancestors can look like, and so on. And that he also felt the church should make an apology for that kind of colonial imposition. And I think that was really interesting to learn more about, you know, that like there is this kind of dialogue with Christianity entering into these non-Christian spaces and traditions and trying to figure out like what to do with them, how to interact with them. And, you know, in many cases, too, Asian Christianities are more syncretic or more open to kind of mixing together a variety of different traditions. So I think that's kind of like an ongoing process, but one that is really historically fraught and, you know, with lots of examples of kind of syncretic experiments being tried and then sort of put down, but surviving nevertheless among practitioners of the faith. So in that way, it's like not dissimilar even to the Latin American experience, for example, or the colonial experiences in Africa or whatever. But it is dissimilar insofar as like the way it happens in Asia is different than the way it happens in the Americas or Africa.
Right. That does make sense. Well, we're kind of coming up to the end of the hour here, and you don't have a book to promote or anything like that yet. So I will ask you this question. It seems like, okay, this is my perspective as a person sitting in the Western world. Christianity is like this very weird and like protected box, right? That we have like Christianity is this set of things and it acts this particular way, whatever. It seems like it would really benefit people in the West to figure out like what's happening with theology, especially like liberation theologies and other types of, I don't know, liberation oriented theologies, for lack of a better term, or at least I can't think of a better term at the moment. How can people in the West learn more about these things that are like seemingly so distant from them?
Yeah, that is also a good question. And one that I think there's actually not a super good answer for, which is something I thought about a lot at the forum. You know, like we have a whole podcast about Christianity in the left. I've spent a long time reading liberation theology, studying it and so on. And I've never met any of these people in my life before that I met at this forum. And I think that is wild. Like, I work really hard to know what's going on in liberation theology. And still, like, you know, this is my first time being in this particular space, which has happened for many, many years and so on. So I think, like, we've talked about this on the show in the past, too. But at a certain point, the kind of media environment and even the publishing environment that allowed liberation theology to find its way into the Anglophone sphere kind of collapsed. You know, journalists died or, you know, didn't get published as much or whatever. The publishing industry didn't hire new translators, I guess. Like, I don't really know all the details there, but it's just harder to know. So I think, like, to be honest, I mean, not to toot our own horn, but I think it's these kinds of projects like our podcast that I hope would sprout up even more. Like, you know, it's important that people go out of their way to try to learn for themselves and then also share that knowledge with what's going on around the world. I will say one interesting thing that came out of this meeting is that the theologians there are going to start a journal that I think we'll publish fairly soon. And it's an open access journal in four languages, English, French, Portuguese, and Spanish. And when it finally goes live or whatever, I guess we'll link to it on this podcast. But, you know, like that's one space to do it. I think there's probably lots of spaces where people meet and talk, especially in the global South. But, you know, it requires like knowledge of languages that aren't English and lots of kind of effort. So all that to say, I think if you're listening to this podcast, you want to know more about liberation theology, you should go learn about it. You should try to find out, figure out where people are talking about it and how, and then find a way to disseminate that information or share it among other folks. Because at this stage, I think it just requires kind of more informal knowledge sharing. And maybe out of that, you know, someone will start some great liberation theology news source. But until then, I think it's this kind of thing, these kinds of projects. That's the way to do it.
Great. A seamless and organic plug for our own podcast. That's great. kind of come full circle. It's such a bonkers thing.
You know, I will.
No, go ahead.
I will just plug at the very end. Mitri Raheb's book. That would be the one thing I would plug. A book that I didn't write, but he wrote a book called Decolonizing Palestine. And it was published actually just before last October. And I read it last year. It is really good. He talks a lot about the kind of history of settler colonialism and colonial theologies and how they contribute to the colonialism in Palestine. And he draws a lot of interesting links between the experience of settler colonialism in the Americas and Australia and elsewhere, and what's happened in Palestine. And I really think that he's one of those voices that, like, Christians in the West right now especially should be, like, going out of their way to read and also, like, share and promote, because I think that's the voice that people need to hear is a Palestinian voice. So that was a big thing that came out of the forum, a commitment to solidarity with Palestinians. And I really feel like his kind of work is, like, doing everybody else a favor by making that actually very easy by, like, writing a lot of good accessible material to help people get their heads around it.
That's great. If this podcast is going to do nothing else, it is going to recommend a book to you to read. It's great. It's just such a striking, like, I don't know, gulf that exists when I'm hearing you talking about all of this. You spent like 2 weeks in Nepal, and you're with all these, like, liberation theologians from around the world. And yet, over here, like, we are existing in a world where, like, the, like, leading voices in Christianity are people like, I don't know, Franklin Graham or whatever. It's just like such a hard terrain to really think about how these weird competing forces exist in the world. And one you can't, like, escape from, and the other you, like, are desperately trying to figure out more about, and it's hard to do.
It's true. You know, the unsettling thing, though, is, like, so Franklin Graham, maybe he's the big bad Christian guy over here. But the troubling thing is, like, another huge theme in the forum was talking about the rise of evangelical fundamentalism in Asia and elsewhere and all across the global South, that, you know, it's like the U.S. is exporting its right. particular form of extremely bad Christianity with bad music, bad politics, bad culture, and so on. And it is catching on all over the place. So I actually think that there's a lot of helpful, like, helpful points of knowledge sharing too. Like, one great contribution I was able to make at many kind of lunchtime conversations was explaining evangelicalism to people who have, like, basically never encountered it or, like, don't really understand it, except that these people are, you know, completely bizarre and, like, don't make sense to them in their cultural context and so on. So I actually think there's maybe a role for people who have grown up in the global North to, like, you know, help people who are just sort of, like, encountering the first salvos of evangelicalism in other countries to be like, here's what you should get ready for.
Yikes. Well, that's a great contribution that we can have as explainers of the extremely bizarre and alien world of evangelicalism people. You know, I was walking downtown Glasgow the other day, and it was, like, really busy, and there's lots of people around, and there's always, like, buskers, like, on the whatever, on the pedestrian streets, and they're oftentimes playing, like, trad music or, I don't know, something else that you'd expect in Scotland, like bagpipes. But I did, mm-hmm. I was walking down the street and people were playing like late 90s worship music. And it put me on edge. No, I was just like, I have to escape. This can't be, you can't do this here. It should be illegal.
It should be. There should be a law.
There should be. I'm going to write to King Charles himself. Nah, he doesn't have anything to say about Scotland, but
well, there's still time. Yeah,
there's still time. That's right.
One last thing before we go, I guess. There was a statement that came out from the World Forum on Theology and Liberation. It's pretty short. It's not, like, I don't know, extremely detailed or anything, but it's cool that they made the statement at the end. I guess that we made the statement at the end. I was participating in it, that the statement was made. I'll share, we can put the link in the show notes. But it maybe gives a sense too of kind of the, at least the things that the theologians there felt like compelled to say following the end of the World Social Forum. So the theologians, they're doing theology, they're making statements, they're out there, they're still at it, and you too could do liberation theology right now. There's nothing stopping you, dear listener, from doing it.
Huh. Makes you think. That's a good note to end on. I probably should have just let you end on that note and not said something afterwards. I'll let this out. No big deal.
All right.
Thanks for listening to the Magnificast. If you like what you heard, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/themagnificast. If you support $2 or more, you get an invite to our cool Patreon Discord channel. And it's fun and full of people and life and learning. It's great. We've been reading the Bible together recently. That was our New Year's resolution, is to read the Bible together. Some people have fallen off the bandwagon, and I'm calling you out right now at the end of our podcast to jump back on the bandwagon.
It's me. Sorry.
Yeah, exactly. it's okay. Just jump back in. We're up to Ruth right now. You don't have to even read the stuff you missed. You can just jump into Ruth and get on it. No one's going to make you feel bad about it except for me right now. Sorry, Dean. our intro music is by Mario Armstrong. Our outro music is by The Logical Spoon. And we'll see you next week.
I don't want to get up for church in the morning. Church in the morning. Souls alive. Heaven come to earth and there won't be no church. We'll meet down by the riverside. There we'll swim with all creation. Never get tired, never bored. Don't worry, someday there'll be no dam between us and our Lord. Jackson, keep your hoods up. Will you keep your hoods up and you stay up late? Jackson, you keep your hoods up. Will you keep your hoods up and you stay up late? Oh, don't mind a cold night, but we might mind if you leave too soon. So come on now, it's still early, at least I would have.